This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Joining us this morning to talk about Pierre de Coubertin is Professor Bob Barney, who's an emeritus professor with the University of Western Ontario, a sports historian and the author of The Gold in the Rings, The People and the Events That Transformed the Olympic Games. Hello, Bob.
Good evening. How are you? Good morning or afternoon, whatever it is there.
Oh, we call it whatever we like, Bob. Hey, Bob, why is it that it's a Frenchman that brings or introduces again the Olympics and not someone from Greece?
Well, actually, there was an experiment to reincarnate the modern Olympic Games in Greece that took place in the even before Coubertin was born, about 5 years before he was born. And there was also an attempt to establish, a successful attempt to reestablish Olympic Games in sort of a folk atmosphere in England. So there were two models there, both of which Coubertin knew about as he started to think about the Olympic Games. But in terms of Coubertin and the French, don't forget that there are many things that Coubertin faced during his early youth and his teenage years and his early college years. And these were set in the Victorian period, just after and immersed in part by the Franco-Prussian War and the defeat of France. And one must not forget, too, that Coubertin grew up in a period in the late 19th century where the peace movement in the world was growing some momentum with the establishment of things like the Red Cross, for instance, and the European peace movement and the world peace movement. And he was in his youth, in his Jesuit education, he certainly knew something about the classics and about the place of the Olympic Games in classical literature and in classical times, as that literature portrayed them. So he has some background here, but he was the first to really follow through and take active measures to institute what today we call the modern Olympic movement.
So was his interest as much in a sporting event as it was one that will unify?
You know what? His primary interest was one that would unify. His interest in physical education and sport in general, a lot of which was influenced by his trips to England and the viewing of sport in the public schools there, he was really motivated to bring together young people in an atmosphere that would promote harmony, peace, brotherhood, understanding, tolerance, fair play, these types of values upon which the Olympic movement rests today and which makes it a very attractive item for a lot of people around the world. As a sporting event, he knew that sport, growing in importance, growing in popularity in the late 19th century and into the next, would be a fulcrum which would appeal to young people to come together. He had to have some sort of motivation for them, and this did the trick. But primarily, his motivation was one to unify.
Because you mentioned the Franco-Prussian War then, how much of an influence did that have upon his decision to want to unify?
Darn good question. And one can only speculate on that. He was only 8 years old when the war culminated. And so how much of an influence it had on him is hard to understand. But he did realize one thing as the years went by, that the vitality of French youth itself needed to be addressed. And their physical education, sporting motifs in public schools, in private schools needed to be addressed. He thought they were way, way behind the British. And so as far as the war itself, it was a humiliating moment for France. No one likes their country to be humiliated because they themselves are humiliated.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, at that age, it can have a marked effect on children, which can then have an effect on them as adults as well.
That's true.
Well, you talked about the rugby school and the English schooling system and sporting system within that. In what way was that significant?
Well, he travelled extensively to England on a couple of occasions. He travelled to the United States on two different occasions where he viewed university sport in action. What he was struck by in his first visits to England was the fact that the boys themselves were largely responsible for organizing and administering the sporting programs that took place in their school. Now, these were not competitions between schools. They were competitions within schools, between houses and dorms, or forms, or classes, if you will. And he was just struck by how vigorous it was and how participatory it was for all the youth, whether they were gifted in sporting attributes or not. So he was tremendously struck. There's no doubt about it. This was a major influence. It's almost like he got a word from above, but he got it in the form of a picture. And much of his early life, at least, was dedicated to trying to bring something about similar to this in France. He was never really successful during his lifetime about that. But nevertheless, that's where his inspiration came from.
And that was the significance and the importance of participation, and that there was an expectation that if you were part of the house or the faction or the colour that was part of the school system, it was important that everybody was a participant in some way.
That's correct. And you remember the dictum that's attributed to Coubertin as sort of a slogan. The important thing is not to win or compete. The important thing is to participate. Now, I'm paraphrasing. I don't have the exact words in front of me. But that stood as sort of an emblem for the Olympics as it went forward in its early youth.
Steve has done that. Hello, Steve.
Good day, Harry.
Good, thank you. What did you want to ask, Steve?
I was going to inquire about when the 16 Olympics were meant to be held.
And why that Olympics, though?
Because the 1940 Olympics were meant to be held in Tokyo, mm-hmm. but they got waylaid because of other events occurring at the time. But there must have been a 1916 Olympics because there were a 1912 Olympics and a 1920 Olympics. So the middle... But because World War One was happening, but... 1916 would have been allocated to somebody or other.
Bob, do we know that?
Well, the 1916 Olympics were the first ones that were really missed. As the gentleman remarked, they were missed again in 1940 and 1944 because of World War II. And certainly those games in 1916 were cancelled because of World War One. Now, Berlin had been awarded those games in 1910, I believe, or 1911. And in effect, they had made quite a good deal of progress in preparing for them. In fact, some of those preparations embedded in 1916 were used in 1936 when the Germans built the site for the games of the 11th Olympiad, which was celebrated in Berlin, of course. And the war brought about some disastrous circumstances for the Olympic movement. Actually, not only did the games shut down, but Coubertin was besieged at times, particularly by the Americans, to hold the games in 1916, but transfer them out of war-torn Europe into North America. That never got off the starting block, so to speak. And, in effect, they were not celebrated. Another thing the war did was to pit in actual fighting on the fronts. Skirmishes that involved troops under the command of British and German IOC members, to the point where, after the war, Britons, who felt the fault of the whole war was Germany, refused to serve in the IOC if the German IOC members were still lodged in their place. And this led to Germany being banished in part until 1928, when they first came back into the Olympic movement after after they had been awarded the games and never held them in 1916. I hope that explains it.
Yeah, but it's interesting, and we'll go back to Pierre de Coubertin and the first Olympics and how he got interested in the ancient Olympics. But just on that, because people say that politics should never be involved in sport or the Olympics, it's not as if it's anything new.
Gosh, politics has been embedded in the Olympics. It's probably embedded in everything we do, whether we know it or not. Certainly in the Olympics, it has it's always had a posture between individuals, between groups, between countries, and there's ample evidence of that. Look at the Cold War, for instance, between 1948 and 1992, that almost half a century of rivalry between the East and the West, the Soviets and the Americans. My gosh, that period was so embroiled by politics at every elbow, at every turn, that it certainly laid to rest any opposers of the thought that politics has never been a part of the Olympic Games.
Bob, let's go back to Pierre de Coubertin. How did he go from an interest in school sports and the English school system and the sports through to an interest in the Olympic Games and the ancient Olympic Games for that matter?
Well, he was a sportsman himself. There's no doubt about that. We have evidence that he fenced, he rode, and he ran. And in fact, he was instrumental in bringing together two disparate groups, amateur sporting groups in France, to exist under one umbrella, a sports governing agency. And so he had this experience. Now, he got his Greek background certainly from his Jesuit education and the study of the classics in that curriculum. Putting these together, he started to dabble with thoughts about physical education in French schools, and he ended up, though, establishing, holding a conference on physical education in 1892, and in which he proffered the word Olympics, but it fell on deaf ears. 2 years later, he formulated a conference which really was intent on trying to get consensus throughout the world sporting agencies on what amateur was, the difference between an amateur and a professional, because that was the focus of attention on a lot of sporting groups at that time. And buried at the end of that agenda, almost like an afterthought, was his notation that, we'll discuss the possibilities of reestablishing the ancient games only in modern times. Well, when the conference met, and it was a big conference, it was lavishly underwritten financially by Coubertin himself, who wasn't hurting for pennies at that time, and he's a wealthy person, came from a wealthy family. And he never attended any of the sessions that devoted their attention to the amateur question, which most of the delegates did. Instead, he caucused or cornered himself with the few members that came to the conference that were interested in reestablishing the Olympics. And there, in a very short time, they hammered out the decision to move ahead with the foundation of the Olympic Games, to establish an IOC, which they preliminarily did at that conference. So, and then they presented the whole idea to the end of the conference meeting of all delegates. And the delegates caught up with a lot of champagne, a lot of good food, and tremendous music and celebration and ritual and so on. They'd vote for anything, and they voted for the Olympic Games. They never did solve the amateur question.
Hey, just with that, where did the delegates come from? Did delegates come from sporting bodies or from people within the political system of each country?
Well, they came. A lot of them came not particularly from the political system. They certainly came from wealthy factions that were interested in sport. A lot of them had titles, for instance. One must remember this was a time in which there were very few sporting organizations per se, official sporting organizations that represented a sport in a particular country or a group of sports in a particular country. So it was sort of like the Neanderthal days of organization. So the delegates at large were people interested in sports. Some of them had had university affiliation, like the American William Sloan, and who came and became a fast friend of Coubertin's and was his man in America, so to speak, to keep him up to date with how things were progressing in America in terms of sport and in terms of their interest in the Olympics. So it was a very eclectic group of people. Some of them were half-heartedly in the developing field of what we call today physical education. Some were in particular and specific amateur sports in their country, in their own country. Some came from royal families, if you will, or connected families in society. And a few came from politics. There's no doubt about that. Coubertin was very adept at arranging his conference literature, his letterheads with the names of noted people in all sorts of affairs, both government and social during his time.
We'll come back to that in just a sec, because we'll bounce around a little bit as listeners call in. Joe, good morning.
Hey, I'm interested in the controversy with at the 1936 Olympics, when Jesse Owens won and Hitler didn't acknowledge it. Was there any similar controversy in any other games?
Bob?
No, not that has been recorded. And, of course, Hitler never did enter into a handshaking episode with Jesse Owens, as some authors have reported. He did not do that. He was told by Bernard Latour, the IOC president at that time in the 1930s, that if you shook hands with one athlete, you'd have to shake hands with all of them. And that ended that. And Hitler listened. He listened, and he carried on without shaking hands of anyone. That's a myth.
One of the things that I want to know about is that you've talked about how this group of people came together and they've decided that they'll establish an Olympic Games. How did they then get that IOC body, firstly, to decide what sports and which countries and how they then incorporate those countries together?
Yeah. Well, the thing that Coubertin insisted on from the start, and what the IOC does today and always has done, is that the games be ambulatory. In other words, they not be celebrated in a particular place. They be celebrated every 4 years in the great cities of the world, as he put it. You got this idea for an international games from William Penny Brooks, the English doctor in a little village in southern England, in Shropshire, who organized the games surrounding an Olympic-like festival culture as early as in the 1850s, before Coubertin's birth. And I spoke about earlier in the program. Now, with these games being, and actually he got the idea of an international festival from William Penny Brooks, except Brooks differed on one thing. Brooks wanted the games celebrated internationally, yes, but always in Athens. And he couldn't see that at all. So he wanted them ambulatory, and present at those first IOC meetings was a Greek delegate, not a sportsman at all, but a poet and a writer, Dimitri Vitalis, who had been contacted by the Greeks, the amateur sporting federation in Greece, a club. Actually, it was a club. and asked him if he'd go over and represent Greece at the conference. He did, and it was he that offered Greece, after conferring with the people who sent him, who offered Greece as the site of the first games. And he had a lot to do with going back to Greece. He really got into the project, even though it was out of his realm of expertise. It was out of his realm of experience. But he got into it, and he gained the good offices and the ear of the Greek royal family, the king, and particularly his son, the crown prince. And together they were able to make the necessary organizational function go. And they got the financing, one of the largest, a wealthy Greek in Alexandria, Egypt, but nevertheless a Greek, who paid for the entire stadium to be raised from its antiquity days into what would become the first Olympic stadium that we know, and the Panathenaic Stadium there in Athens, used by tourists, and in which they held the 2004 Olympic Games archery events. So he had Vikelis, and he had the support of Europeans, and he had the first sight, even though when he went to visit Greece for the first time before the Games were held in 1896, he was sort of shoved aside. The Greeks were very zealous that they were going to do it by themselves under their own plan. But nevertheless, those games came off handsomely. They wouldn't come off again as handsomely until maybe 2008, and maybe even not until 1908 and 1912.
We're taking a look this morning at Pierre de Coubertin, this morning, who is one of the people or behind the what we consider to be the modern Olympics. Our guest this morning is Professor Bob Barney, Emeritus Professor at the University of Western Ontario, a sports historian and author of The Gold in the Rings, The People and Events That Transformed the Olympic Games. Bob, what role did Pierre have in that initial Olympic organization?
He passed the presidency. The plan originally with Coubertin was that wherever the games were held, whatever country they were held in, that the IOC member from that country would be the president of the IOC for that period of time, that 4 years leading up to the games. And then after the games, when they had the next site identified, that the IOC member from that new site would be the president. But after the very first games, Coubertin decided that it would be better if there'd be one person consistently in charge of this, so that he could move things along from a knowledge base and experience base, better than a newcomer each 4 years. And in effect, he saw to it that following the Greek games, he replaced Vitalis as the president of the IOC and stood in there through and including the 1920 until the 1924 games in Paris were celebrated. Then he stepped down because he died in 1937, but he was still active in Olympic affairs as a spokesperson, and who knows, from a political point of view, in reaching particular decisions that they had to reach.
Shane's called. Hello, Shane.
Yeah, g'day. I was just wondering about when the torchbearers started. I believe Hitler started that torch-bearing symbol to start the Olympics when they run into the stadium with the torch. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I believe it is. Can you confirm that? Or
Bob?
Well, the Olympic flame, the sacred fire, as they call it, was something that made a belated entrance into Olympic ritual and protocol and celebration. And the first flame displayed in a stadium for the Olympic Games occurred in Amsterdam in 1928. And as the German contingent marched into those games in the opening ceremony, remember, they had been excluded from the games. They hadn't taken part since 1912. and because of their role in the First World War. And when they marched into that stadium, one of the representatives of the German contingent was Karl Diem, a noted organizer of amateur sport, as it turned out, a college professor. And he looked up at that flame, and something clicked in his mind. He then looked at his everybody that participated in the games, officials, got an Olympic medal, a participation medal. And this medal had been constructed by a Dutch engraver. And he used the theme of that flame above the stadium, the tower, the marathon tower, they call it, on top of which the flame and the cauldron burned. He used that as a theme for one side of his medal. So Diem had two things to remind him of sacred fire and the Olympic, and its link to the Olympic Games. Now, before then, there had been no Olympic flame. There had been no torch relays or what have you. But there had been reference to flame, passing the flame on, things like this, but nothing really concrete. So it's a testimony to Jan Wills, the architect of that stadium in 1928, because when he first presented his drawings to city council for building that stadium, he had a marathon tower, he had a cauldron, he did not have a flame coming from it, he had searchlights coming from it. He resubmitted, and the second design that he submitted had, in effect, a flame. And that flame was turned on at night only and for ceremonial occasions. It did not burn during the day except for the opening ceremonies the first time. So they had to light it, a gas line that went up to the flame. They had to light it each night and then to extinguish it. So it was Diem then who got the idea of having a torch relay. And now the story goes, of course, that Diem was had some knowledge of the classics, the ancient Olympic Games, and that he knew some evidence of Greek sport rested on vase paintings of athletes performing. And there are certainly there are a number of well-known vase scenes in museums around the world with a runner in antiquity running with a torch and passing it to another. So Diem took it from there, laid his plans before the Greeks in Greece, before the IOC, and in effect, the Greeks who were organizing the going to organize the torch run, as Jean pointed out and designed it in Olympia, and that's exactly what happened. The torch was lit in Olympia, and it was run through a series of relays all the way to Berlin and entered the stadium at the time of the opening ceremony. Very, very pregnant moment in Olympic history, and one which goes forward to this very day, as we all saw when the Tokyo Olympics opened the other day. So Diem has to be given the credit for the torch relay, but a lot of people think he was the one who actually had the idea of the flame in the cauldron. And that wasn't it at all. That was purely Jan Wills's endeavor, and hardly anybody knows that today.
Hey, Bob, did Pierre de Coubertin want any of the traditions from the ancient Olympics to be brought forward and into the modern Olympics?
Well, yes. One thing he certainly brought forward as a tradition was to have no women participate. No women in antiquity were allowed at the Olympic Games that were carried out every 4 years and which had only male spectators and male athletes, and male coaches, and male officials. That was one thing that he brought forward. Always resisted women competing in the Games, but pressures came from Great Britain, from the United States in particular, to have women compete, and he grudgingly acceded to that as he made his way through the latter years of his presidency. So that gender exclusion was one. Another controversial point at the time goes back to the very reason he held that 1894 Sorbonne concert at the Sorbonne in Paris, where the modern Olympic movement was birthed, so to speak. And when you go back there to that item, he laid down very specifically that we should follow the English tradition of the amateur motif. But you know what? My feeling is that was far less of a concern of his than many other things, such as financing the games, which invariably took the government's help to do that in those days. So the amateur question was far less important in his mind than the encroachment of commercialism on the games, for instance. He saw that beginning to happen in the last 20 years of his life. And if he were around today, my God, he would faint, I think, because he was...
Bob, how many countries were there in that first Olympics, and how many events, how many sports?
Good question. I don't have the stats at my fingertips, but I think that the number of athletes was about 300 and some odd athletes, and I think it was 18 countries in 1896. And now, of course, there are almost 11,000 athletes and over 200 countries that participate. If Coubertin was alive today and see how the Olympics go off, he would certainly be, I think he'd be satisfied with the things he sees in today's games that, in effect, took place in his own time, such as the victory ceremonies, for instance, and the playing of anthems and the raising of national flags. That took place in 1896, and it certainly was in place well before he died and all during his presidency.
Kev, hello.
Hi, Trev.
Yes, Kev.
I've been up regarding rugby in the Olympic Games. I believe that Coubertin was responsible for rugby being in the Paris Games and a couple of others afterwards, because I believe he was a referee and also a bit of a rugby freak, and I believe that he was responsible for the introduction of rugby back in the early days.
Bob?
Yes, the caller is correct. In 1924, there was a rugby tournament. Actually, Coubertin refereed rugby, not at the Olympic Games, but in the park in French competitions. Rugby was very popular in France, still is to this day. It made its appearance in 1924. The United States team won that medal, and my football coach at the University of New Mexico was a member of that rugby team and an All-American at Stanford. And he was my coach in his senior years, a wonderful man. I'll never forget him. And I'll never forget that rugby for a moment, a fleeting moment, was in the Olympic Games as early as the 1920s.
Bob, just before we go, this not going back to Coubertin, but how do you think, as a historian of the Olympics, that Tokyo will sit in history as part of the Olympic movement?
Well, it will certainly sit in history as the only games likely to have been celebrated in an odd-numbered year. It will go down in history as a game, as at least to date, I'm putting it, I'm looking backward now, not forward. It's the only games that have been threatened to be canceled by a medical pandemic. They have been canceled by wars, and they've been boycotted during political situations during the Cold War, of course. But the legacy is there. You know, things like the Olympic Games today grow Olympiad by Olympiad, each one of them like a life cycle, making contributions, making modifications, making new things happen, and each contributing to a picture that we see today. That did not happen overnight. And certainly at the bottom of that pyramid that life cycle was Pierre de Coubertin, a most energetic individual, a most principled individual. You could say those good things about him. The Americans thought he was a little bit of a fuss budget and my way or the highway individual, but nevertheless, he must be accorded sensational acclaim for what he established.
It's been a pleasure talking to you this morning, Bob, and for you telling us a little bit about de Coubertin and his significant role in the modern Olympics. Thank you again.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, and thank you for your invitation.
Professor Bob Barney, Emeritus Professor at the University of Western Ontario, a sports historian and the author of The Gold in the Rings, The People and Events That Transformed the Olympic Games. You are listening to Overnights with Trevor Chappell on ABC Radio.